B. Overlooked local attack techniques.
This is a marvelous day. Do you realize Las Vegas gets 5 inches of rain a year and we're getting it all today? A 100-year flood, something like, but at the same time, we're completely insulated here from all of it. You wouldn't know that there is a disaster going on outside until you get out to it. Casinos are designed that way. You never know what is going on in the outside until it's already happened. Information security is a lot like that. Things happen, but you never find out about it until too late. Nowadays, it's getting worse. Used to be we had some warning, some idea of the vulnerabilities that were going on. But nowadays, we're getting attacks seen simultaneously with discovery. It used to be a virus had come out. We'd have 3 or 6 months between the time it would be received by the researchers and the time anyone would actually see it on the outside. That has changed. Melissa proved it. A virus discovered the same day that it hit everybody. Is there anyone here who didn't experience Melissa, doesn't have a copy of it? You don't have a copy of Melissa? I was going to say, the entire world was measured. In fact, one of the jokes among the security community was not, did you have Melissa, but how many copies did you get? Because that determined how popular you were. It is a changing world, and we need to respond to it. And unfortunately, in the past, we have responded in onesies and twosies, the same way we would at home. And we don't take advantage of the things that a large internal network provides. Right now, we're something over 200,000 computers. We are larger than the internet was when the Morris worm hit. So we have a pretty good cross-section of what's going on. Things happen anywhere. But at the same time, there are advantages to that. And what I'd like to talk about today are some of those advantages that the home team can take that provide security mechanisms that aren't available generally to people on the outside. Now, the first question is, why bother? For years, we have treated security as one size fits all. You put up a firewall. It doesn't matter if you have one Class C subnet or if you have three Class A's. One size fits all. But that doesn't work today. The attacks are coming faster, and the number of gateways you have determines just how fast you get that attack. The better the system, the more modern the system, the more vulnerable it is. They're using novel mechanisms for attack. I used to come under bothered years ago at the NSA for saying that these were covert channels, and people would talk to me, no, a covert channel is a timing channel. And it was interesting that in one of the later revisions of the Rainbow, somebody apparently agreed with me, and they put any unintended channel. Now, the problem is, why are these unintended? Because software has gotten so large and so complex, and it doesn't really matter what system you're talking about, even though if you're use the software from Redmond, you tend to be a little bit more exposed, simply because everyone has it. It's available, it's easy, it's cheap. So we don't have the advantages of, say, somebody trying to use Multics. Now, I wouldn't wish Multics on anyone, but at the time, there were systems using Multics, and they were safe because nobody knew how to break into them. That didn't mean they weren't vulnerable. It meant no one knew how. Now, I'm not saying it was vulnerable. I'm just saying we didn't know. Whereas today, we have systems that are being stress tested. Who in their right mind would write an IP address as an octal string? How many people know what happens with what when you do that? No one knows what I'm talking about? The famous, if you do Internet Explorer, and you express the address as an octal string. This was prior to the patch, which everybody's put in, of course. Excuse me? Yes, local. It is us. It ain't out there. It's here. Now, the point I'm trying to make is that's a little bit like the first man to eat an oyster. Who on earth would think that way? Of course, the answer is partially what we saw in Dr. Mudge's session. Anybody who reviewed the source code would see that if you put this kind of an address in, it will handle it this way. And I just like that little bit of confirmation for you that the source code of things like Internet Explorer are available to people who will study them and will make use of them. But anyway, response is slow. Years ago, didn't matter. Concept virus comes out August 1995. Actually, July is the date I've seen. Did anybody actually get the concept virus in 1995? Around January 96 was when it started to hit, and then it hit everybody. But there was a lag. We knew about it. There was time to update the scanners, to create the defenses for that type of thing, even though we'd never seen anything like it before. But that isn't true today. Nothing worse than an expert out of their field. What happens when you take an antivirus person who's never seen a Word macro? This is another problem we've got, that we've got a lot of experts that are truly experts in their area. The problem is figuring out what their area is. So make sure you can tell. Here's an example. You notice I have enclosed the full URL. Anyone know what a collaborative data object is? Ever use them? Nobody. Okay. Basically, that's on the Microsoft Developers Network. I have to use the name because this is how you can find it. And it says very simply, if you can read the summary, with those of you against the back wall probably can't. Incorporate email into your client application. Doesn't that sound like Melissa? You want to know how to write a virus like Melissa? You don't look on the bulletin boards of the virus writers. Look in the Microsoft Developers Network. It'll tell you exactly how to do it. Or try that one. Again, the URL's up at the top. In fact, if you look at the URL name, enabling your program for mail lets you easily implement a send command to mail your documents using the mail client on a user's machine. Now, this is a feature, right? Everybody wants to send mail from applications, right? No? You don't? You do. You have an application that does it. No, yeah, sometimes. The question comes, with all of this available and without being able to go through 14 CDs every 6 months to find out what new features have appeared and what exactly those features mean, how do you defend? It's not an easy question. It is difficult today because as a defender, you need to close every hole that exists in a system, not just one, but that is all an attacker needs to get into a system. So really, anybody who is in the security business today has to be grossly egotistical, because that's obviously an impossible task. But what we can do is mitigate the risk. Right now, I am seeing a lot of corporations using the school of fish approach. That one being, do nothing, hope the shark will take somebody else. That's certainly the cheapest approach. And if you look on a cost-benefit analysis, that is probably the best approach to take. Just keep your resume updated. I'm going to stop asking questions because people don't know. In case you're interested, a tontine was essentially a life insurance policy of the 17th century, early 18th century. The last person left got everything. And that is the way a number of industries and corporations are headed right now, because their defenses are purely inadequate. So what they're doing is hoping to be the last one left. Others just keep resume updated. That's an easy answer. Okay, if defense is to work, the defenders need an unfair advantage. We're giving away too much to the attackers. So we need to use things that are not really applicable to attack, or can be used in such a way that they aren't available to attackers. Now, the first one is a perimeter defense. You don't have just a perimeter defense or a firewall, but that is the first place. And the reason a perimeter defense is important is because it is also the easiest and most cost-effective defense you can put in place. Because any defense has to be organic and kept in updated to new attacks. A perimeter defense at your gateways, you know where it is. You know how to keep it up. You can shut it off in a minute if necessary. Of course, how many people here, I will ask this question, how many people here are authorized to close their gateways without consulting anybody? One, two, three, the rest of you, could you close the gateways in 15 minutes if you had to? One person, a couple of people could, not many. These are the ones the sharks aren't going to get. Okay, the perimeter defense, because it's the easiest. Desktop defense is what everyone talks about. And I'm not going to say it's so much a popular means, because the vendors make more off a desktop defense than they do off a perimeter. But one thing I will say is my experience in a very large network is you can't keep all desktops updated quickly. In fact, you will have areas that won't update at all. So that is of limited value, period. Now, you've got to have one, because that is the only point at which everything comes together. It needs to be your primary line of defense if you can keep the updates. Now, I have hopes within the next year or so to see real fast automatic update mechanisms for antivirus and security pieces. We don't really have them yet, though we've got a lot of marketing. Next, you need a layered defense. One thing a number of corporations found out with Melissa specifically was a single point of defense doesn't work. Those people who went down for long periods of time had single layered defenses, either desktop or gateway, and they found out that wasn't enough. So it must be layered, a defense in depth. And the big thing is, this is not just an administration job anymore. It used to be one of security meant RACF or CA top secret. All the rules were laid out, how you set up account, how you protected account, what information must be protected. But with organic attacks, you don't have time to look at books. You have to be able to react immediately to new effects. And that means you have to understand what is happening quickly. Now, for years, tools have been designed for universal applications. One size fits all. Can be launched from anywhere. I'm talking things like internet scanners, very popular today. And as we found out with BackRFS, there are many ways around internet scanners. Can be launched from anywhere, operate across bridges and firewalls, because they throw away the local information. And I'm going to talk about that a bit. They operate unattended. They don't require somebody in layers. In fact, they are designed to be automatic. Now, when I do a characterization of a network, I just don't take something and crank it up and fire it at the network. I go through a process, and in fact, this morning, those of you who stayed for the A session, the firewall penetration, well, other than the fact I still don't know how they got to port 135 across the firewall when the firewall wasn't passing 135, but we don't have to go into that one. But the thing of it is, you lose information when you cross it. So the first thing you wanted to do, and they had a very good process, is what do you have? You don't run a exhaustive scan on every machine in your network, because there's no reason to. If the only thing the machine is responding to is port 135, what you have is a Windows 95 machine. And if it's not running any servers, there's no point in further scanning. So you run a pinger, find out what responds. You run a limited socket identification routine to find out what you have. And then you massage that. And because you can talk to the admins, you can find out which machines are considered critical to the environment and which aren't. To somebody coming in from the outside on a penetration test, and let me tell you, I hate penetration tests. I think they're a waste of time. But for somebody coming in from the outside, you'll see all these suns. You'll have little idea of what their purpose or what their importance is or what their hardening or what their function is. But to the insider, you have that information available. And you can prioritize which machines are critical, which machines aren't critical. And you can put the critical machines on a high priority list. Now, I've been talking a little bit about port scanners, ISS, CyberCops, Satan, Santa, Socket to me. There are a number of them out there. Port Scanner 2000 that we just discussed. These are all good machines, but they can only look at what gets responded to. This is a mechanism. Does this sound like something you know what it's doing? The inside advantage is you can start out with knowledge of what the machine is already. So you don't have to be hitting it with things that you know it won't respond to. You can have specialized tests for specialized types of machines. And because by doing that, you can run very fast. In fact, it's possible to completely analyze a Class B in under a week. And that's with an outbriefing. But you have to do it intelligently. Okay, to hear basically the same attacker defender, home team can pre-identify what the ranges are, where you have things, where you're not. Now, generally, I'll analyze everything on a system because I have never been to an installation yet where the maps were entirely correct. There's always a connection or a gateway or a couple of subnets that Joe put in and nobody ever got around to updating the maps. There's always great surprise when we discover them. But at that point, you can go back and say, what is this? Where is it? Why is this there? Does it have a gateway to the outside that wasn't on any other map before? This isn't something you can do from the outside. Okay, you can identify the hardware in the operating system. You saw software to do that this morning. It's easy. Compare that to the map. By comparing it, does it match what's supposed to be there? Another critical point. Is this machine supposed to be running as a web server? That's not a question that can normally be asked by an outsider. But by correcting the exceptions first, getting rid of the multiple protocols that aren't supposed to be there at all, now you can cut your task way down. Now the scanning runs much faster. Another thing you can do is run port mapper netstat. That has to be run on the machine itself. It will immediately tell you what's running. You don't have to attempt to open a number of ports because the machine might be running it. Using that, you know what it's running. And in fact, it will identify the services, whether expected or not. Now, that's one thing that it can be difficult. For instance, you can walk up to a machine, do the local test, interview the administrator, but as an example, consider the original Mark I back orifice. Scanner can only detect if the user uses the default. One of the interesting things I've never seen mentioned too much is because if you set the password, it won't open a port for you if the packet doesn't have the password in it. A scanner will fail. I have not seen that mentioned very often. And I've been meaning to ask the people who will be around tomorrow whether that was deliberate. But it's be a very good way. If you are on the machine, though, and I know you in the back can't see that, you notice the upper one is a machine running essentially clean. You've got 137, 38, 39, so it's an NT box, or Windows 95, UDP 137, 38, that's a net BIOS component. If you look at this one, you see there's one difference, 31337. That's bare bones back orifice. But if a password were set, ISS and CyberCop would never show that. It can only be done on the machine, but you rarely hear about that because the attack tools are not designed to be run locally. Of course, there's another problem, and if you've got a machine that's actually in use, it's more likely to look like that. But still, if you know what the machine is supposed to look like, or if you can run it immediately after boot, while all of those extra services, by the way, that's an Exchange machine that happens to have a few messages open at the moment, which is why you're seeing so many ports open. It's better if you can run it before any other processes, but that's your prerogative. You make the rules, but you have to make the rules. Consider port scanners themselves. Most check only common ports. The old firewall toolkit checks 31,000 of the 65,000 ports. 16 bits. Remember? That's how many you've got. I remember years ago seeing a fairly well-known firewall that seemed to drop the upper bit. So if you wanted, if it blocked Telnet on port 23, and don't ask me to do the math right now, if you did a Telnet access on 32768 plus 23, it came out the other end as a port 23 request, and the firewall very happily let it go by. Did anyone ever test for something like that? Not with the firewall toolkit. Commercial scanners, typically as many as 100, but very rarely more than that. Why? The round trip time. If you are on a remote node coming across a firewall into a local intranet, you're liable to have to measure that in seconds. Somebody mounting an attack wanting to go quickly will probably scan a machine for as little time as possible, and typically that is measured in seconds. Now, if your round trip time is in milliseconds, obviously you can do a lot more. If you know which machines are critical, you can do a lot more. And if you're local, you can test all 65,000 ports in about 10 minutes. It doesn't take very long. How many people ever scanned a machine for all 65,000 ports? I see some people who are actually intelligent back there. Try this one. Set up a machine to punch all 65,000 ports into a firewall and set a machine on the other side that simply is running promiscuous and will respond to all 65,000 ports. Now you find out exactly what really passes that firewall. And it's a very good test, but I have very rarely seen anyone actually test a firewall that way. That's a home team advantage. Probably wondering why all of them. Well, like I said, it's a nice firewall test, takes two machines. And don't forget, it's really 130,000 something if you're doing UDP. Add a few more if you want to test for ICMP. But once you get done checking all the possible mechanisms, you know what that firewall's passing. and you find out quickly, under a half hour, what's doing. Now, I know there are going to be some people out there saying, why would you do that when you can just look at the firewall? Well, if a defense is just a screening router, and this is why I don't believe in penetration testing. If you've got a simple point, I'll just read the ACLs, tell you where the holes are, and then you can go out and try them. I don't see any purpose in just banging on the ports for the purpose of banging when we've got the insider advantage of being able to read the programming. But if the firewall's a farm, 15 or 25 different machines, you've got gauntlets and a couple of Netscape reverse proxies, and you've got PDMF mail servers, it's often a lot easier to just pump it through and see what happens. Because in a number of cases, in fact, I know of one rather large site in Idaho that got hacked that way because there was a bypass, you find out what gets through. And after finding out what gets through, afterward you can figure out what it was that allowed that vulnerability, but you'd never be able to tell it by looking at 15 or 25 different sets of ACLs. Real world testing works. But again, it isn't something you can do remotely because you can't put that extra machine on the inside. Another thing you can do internally is MAC addresses, and this was just mentioned. Anybody quick and name four different meanings of MAC? Media access code, macro address delimiter, Macintosh, and there's one other, and I keep forgetting it.
So UK is a raincoat.
I'm sorry.
When it rains, they wear them in England.
Oh, okay. That's right, and there's also something about Macintosh, not Macintosh, but ATM transmissions. It's amazing how acronyms multiply. But the thing of it is, every network interface card made, and if you don't have a NIC, you're not on a network, has a unique address that must be there to communicate at all. As soon as you cross a bridge, router, firewall, you lose it, which is what has one great advantage on a very flat structured Class B is you can get the MAC address of every machine in the environment from a single point. You can't do that if it's subnetted. But you can do it if you're internal. 6-byte value. Now, why would you care about that value? Well, I think Donald Smith? I think he knows why you care about MAC values, because that happened to be embedded in a certain Word document, and it is unique to the machine, or the NIC, actually. 6 bytes. First 3 bytes identifies the manufacturer, and usually the model, if it's a large manufacturer. You must open the box to change. A VAX magically becoming a PC does tend to be cause to comment if you knew what the DEC address was initially and you're checking. Of course, that's one of the insider things. You can find out what your machine and your networks are supposed to look like. You can run an inventory. You can find out where that machine is supposed to be. And one of the most difficult things I find a lot of times when I go into a different site, and the number of sites we have is mind-boggling, hardest thing for me to know is when I have to wear a coat and when I don't have to wear a coat. Cultures are different. But the sites are the same. They don't know where their machines are. They have no property records. There may be a beautiful network map, but if I say, where physically is that machine, it is a rare place to actually tell me. Now, a number of years ago, we had an incident involving on a Novell network. Now, Novell's very nice because the address header of a Novell IPX pack that contains the MAC address. And this happened to be a site where we had an inventory. And I believe, Peter, you mentioned about difficulties in forensic analysis when you can't put a person at the machine when something's happened. Well, we had somebody trying to break into a server. We had the security admin called me up, gave me the MAC address. We hit the MAC database of that location, and there was a uniformed guard with guns standing at the machine asking the guy why within 5 minutes. That is known as in progress. And it works, but you have to know where you're going and what you're going with. Okay. What is a MAC? Well, you've seen WinIPC. That's what you get in that case. That's one machine. You see the first three addresses, bytes 006097. Last three bytes uniquely identifies the prom. First three tells me, well, if you've got the IEEE OUI list, then it tells you 006097 is a 3COM corporation machine. Actually a PCMCIA card, but you don't know about the PCMCIA card until you go to the 3COM website and run through their list, and they will have a very nice list. This range is a 3C575. B. Now why B? Oh, let's see. Because if we look at what's in this machine, and can you see the MAC address here? This one's 006008. That's 575D, which is what happens to be in this machine. That is live and what's in that machine right now. So if it wanted to connect to the network, regardless of the IP it's using, it must use that IP, otherwise it will never receive any information. Unless you're set promiscuous, in which case, how do you know which one you're supposed to be receiving? You go from that, and if you're interested, there's the OUI list, which is very nice to have a little program to sort it. But there's 006008, 3COM Corporation, how to contact them. Public information nobody uses because they aren't effective from the outside. Only the home team can use this information because that's the only place you're going to get it. Let's see. Is that the right one? Nope, that wasn't the right one. There we go. All these choices. Sir?
Question. If someone locally administers the MAC address,
yes,
then it's going to start with, it's going to be like a 4,000 number. Does that just totally wipe out your identification process, or is there a way around that?
Wait a second. What do you mean 4,000 number?
Yeah, when you go in and you can configure the MAC address locally, but it has to start with 4000. Well,
you're talking about a VAX mainframe. 11730, you can do that. Most machines, the NIC address is burned into the PROM, particularly on PCs.
I mean, this was an NT machine.
Change it on Solaris.
I'm sorry, I'm blaming TDU on this, but I just went in and just told it to make it a 4000 number, made up a number.
Okay, I'd like information on that. I'd like to see how to do that. I don't doubt that it's simple. Melissa was simple. We just didn't know about it before it happened. So that is something I'd like to know about. Now, I know there is configuration you can do if you're not connected to the network. But the question is, if you reconfigure it on the machine, how does the NIC know to respond to it? Because that's in firmware. Unless you change the prom. Okay, so you can make it anything you want. So now you need an active hub that can only respond. Okay. These features get you. However, how many machines do you suppose... Now that everybody is going to change their MAC address just to see what happens. Fortunately, most users aren't quite that bright. But at any rate, if you have fixed addresses that people haven't discovered how to change yet, then you can use that to determine where a machine is and identify movement, subnets. You can also use active hubs, which answers that question, because I know 3Com does it. I think there are two or three other manufacturers that make active hubs, namely that you program the hub to only receive and send traffic to a specific MAC address, which is the underlying foundation of all networks. And if the hub only sends it, then even if that machine is set to promiscuous, all it will receive is what it's supposed to receive in the first place. Of course, not many people do that because I think it costs about $10 more for a hub like that. And it also requires a certain amount of pre-positioning, though I know a number of government sites that are using this technique right now. Unfortunately, I'm not at liberty to say which. Well, like I said, it defeats promiscuous. Yet another is knowing which IP addresses are assigned. Now, I've been calling those minefields for years. Namely, if you know which IP addresses on a subnet are not assigned, then you can just set up a single machine to respond, record, alarm to any attempt to ping or access that address. And as Marcus mentioned, that is a very common precursor to attack, the access of every address in the range. Now, of course, if you are an insider, you know which machines you can access and which machines you can't. But somebody coming in remotely doesn't know, tries to run the entire range just to find out what's there. And if I have, 120, 121, and 122 unassigned, and all of a sudden I get something that tries to access all three of those addresses within about a 5-minute period, I definitely want to alarm. We now have some dummy addresses in our global address lists that do exactly the same thing. Any attempt to access will create an alarm simply because they don't appear in the normal list. DHCP provides a different problem. I actually consider DHCP more secure for the simple reason that an attacker is not going to know which are and which aren't going to be in use at any given time, and it will change. But it requires an active system with knowledge of what is assigned at any given time. A little bit more difficult. In fact, one of the biggest problems we had was figuring out how to get enough logs. We keep at least 3 months of what assignments are in use and what is using those assignments. But storage is a problem. Trouble is nobody asked anybody how to do that before. Okay. Growing. Is it hot in here?
Yes.
Okay, it's not just me. I'm from Florida, so I shouldn't be feeling it. I mean, if I'm feeling it, you really must be. Okay, growing increasingly important, control of executable attachments and embedded instructions. This is the biggest problem we have today. Users getting an attachment and somehow a certain segment of the population is never going to get the word don't. The problem with that, I imagine you, sir, are old enough to remember Mr. Wizard. Did you ever, anyone ever see the Mr. Wizard atom bomb display with the ping pong balls and the mouse traps? Throws a ping pong ball into a room full of mouse traps. Each mouse trap has two ping pong balls on it, and the world goes ping pong. Well, that is what we are experiencing today with mail bombs. You get one inside, and that one can result in literally thousands of messages. In fact, this was a big difficulty that we had early on with Melissa, because the first words we got, and we were hit right on the first day, was 50 messages would be sent. How many people heard that early on? 50 messages would be sent. Okay, the thing that was completely missed, and this includes a telecon with Microsoft and a number of other intelligent people, was that was 50 messages from each address list. And some of those address lists, if you really used Microsoft Exchange the way it is pitched and use all of its features, you will have some address lists that are nothing but distribution lists. And a distribution list is one message. So coming into Friday night, nobody's had sleep, everybody's panicking, and there are 60,000 infected messages in the mail store. One infected machine sends 50 messages. How many infected machines do you have? Sixth grade algebra? It's everywhere. Now, if we had known that all it had taken was actually two machines to create that number of messages, then we would have reacted considerably different. I think most people would have. But that was one of the things that happened. We didn't know information was bad. So we need to be able to control things that come in. We need to understand what their effects may be. That's an insider advantage. We control what we allow to come in. And if you're filtering all executables at the gateway, very quickly people will find you don't send executables as an email attachment. Now, this is annoying to some. The problem is having a strong enough security organization to say, yes, you are going to be annoyed. Tough. Because here is what happens if we don't annoy you. And when presented that way, people will understand. The risk is just too great, and we're working on fixing that. I'm sorry.
Executable code that can be embedded in documents.
Well, executable, there are two kinds of that. One, executable in a document will either take the form of a macro, or one of the new things we're finding out about is executable HTML. Do I dare ask if anybody has played with the iframe? Now, anyone ever hear of Russian New Year? Yes, you know what it can do, particularly if you have the preview frame turned on. Oh, yes. So, given friends like those, the only choice you really have is block it at the gateway and say, tough. Now, the hard part when you say tough is making that stick. Because I guarantee there are going to be people in the high levels of a corporation that will say, oh, but I want to. And you'd have to be able to overrule them. Now, maybe at some point in the future, as scanning and filtering techniques mature, we'll be able to turn these back on again. Right now, we can't. Period. And there has to be somebody on the home team with the ability to say, thou shalt not. And if you don't have somebody like that, God help you. May need to be creative. For instance, would any of those mail-enhanced viruses have worked if MAPI, your Exchange server, only allowed one message per person per 30 seconds? Consider that. It would still be trying to queue X thousand of messages, but it would take 3 days to do it, and about the 10 minutes of important message from, you probably notice something, unless you have anything decent running. That is containment. Of course, what happens if collaborative data objects is disabled? Can collaborative data objects be disabled? Those of you coming out of the Unix world, that is a wonderful place. You can compile the kernel to do anything you want. You can turn off anything you want. And I have to say, I haven't yet figured out how to turn CDO off. And I don't know if Outlook would work if I did turn CDO off. And I have yet to find anyone who does know. Getting information out of a certain vendor is kind of like pulling teeth, especially when you get down to that level. I think, never mind. Okay, now I guarantee you can't read that. But here's a home team advantage. And if anybody wants it, email me and I'll see you get a copy. That is a script that will simply run out of a Word document. It is a Word macro, and it does one very simple thing. You tell it how many instances from each address list you want it to count, and if you set it to zero, it'll count all of them. And it will tell you just how fast a virus like Melissa will spread, or a Melissa like Explore Zip. Now, that's a beneficial use of MAPI. One other thing you can do with MAPI that I haven't seen anyone mention, of those here are from corporations, and I just filtered that, how many of you consider your telephone book with telephone numbers, addresses, email addresses sensitive? And I'll bet that's a fairly significant percentage. Do you realize with a script like that, you can extract the entire global address list with all the names, addresses, phone numbers, etc., to a Word document, put it on a floppy, carry it out with you? Amazing what you can do if you, once you start really looking at what that code is capable of. Okay, home team advantage, virus scanners. Everybody has them. Right, everybody does have them. Who gets them first? And what's the first thing that happens to a new virus? At least if somebody's taking any kind of care at all without just kind of spewing something out randomly. They're reactive in nature. They have to be, even though a number are getting heuristics now. Best turnaround is measured in hours. And I use that hours number interestingly, because if you have friends in the industry and have set up the lines of communication before an attack ever takes place, you're liable to be able to say hours. If you don't, you're talking days. Maybe. Anyone ever tried to contact McAfee's help desk when a virus attack is in session? Yes, I see a few people have. And those are the people designed to keep you from anyone who actually knows anything. So, but still, it's the best thing we've got. So you'd better have a good one. But understand that in itself is not enough. A destructive attack can take minutes. We just haven't seen one like that yet, but I think a lot of people here know that it could be mounted, particularly if you knew exactly the type of system you were connecting. Years ago, we had 28 different mail systems from every different vendor in the world. We didn't even have a standard network. Oh, but the cost savings of standardization. So nowadays, you vote with your wallet, that's what you get. Scanners are the winner of that one. Used to be there were other things. Keep scanners, ask more. Signing. Windows 2000 brings in digital signing and macros. It is probably the best thing I ever heard of, though, of course, we don't have a PKI to support it yet. Of course, that means everybody has to go to Windows 2000. Everyone has unlimited pocketbooks, right? 64 meg machines and a few other things. Oh, well. But it is a very good thing. I mean, I can seriously see corporations starting to require digital signing of all executables. I don't see it becoming pervasive for 2 to 3 years, but it will happen, and it's probably going to take a major disaster before it does. But we could do it now. We just need the infrastructure. Minor thing. Executable analyzers, unpackers, disassemblers. Sir?
Why not go the other direction? Why not just make sure Microsoft decides to cut?
If you can figure that one out. I mean, don't forget, these aren't bugs, they're features.
Patrick, could you repeat the question, please? There was a request for Jack to repeat his question.
I can't hear. Oh, he asked, why don't we just get Microsoft to fix it? And like I said, the response is, that's not a bug, it's a feature. Everybody wants to send mail from Excel, right? At any rate, that isn't their business. Microsoft has been extremely successful providing features, not security. Anyone ever use the Microsoft antivirus? No? They bought it from somebody who bought it from somebody who bought it from somebody, and it was about 3 years old when they bought it out, and then the antivirus vendor was going to make all their money on the updates, and Microsoft never provided any updates. But they had an antivirus. NT is C2. Yes, the server is C2 if you don't connect it to a network.
It was only
351
at least two.
Yes, 351 service pack and the service pack one, the security pack, which I don't know if I ever saw the security pack. At any rate, of course, they were going to ramp the network connectivity. And I think that was, 3 years ago, 4 years ago? They still haven't ramped it because they got the advertising they want, and that's what makes the bottom line. Okay, integrity managers, used to be some. Wolfgang Schiller had a nice one called Integrity Manager. He just went out of the business. Nobody bought it. SafeWord antivirus. Had CRC validators. They went out of business too. Maybe they were just ahead of their time. But one of the big problems is the people who have survived in the industry made scanners because that is what people bought. Unfortunately, we need to be a bit more creative. Okay, what do you need to do? Well, the first thing you need, if you don't have one, is a crisis management team. It will happen to you. If it hasn't yet, it just hasn't yet. They're coming faster, they're coming more effectively. Effective, good programming, right? Hard to use that term, but that's what we're talking about. Can't afford to delay while somebody pulls together and decides, yes, we're having a crisis. You need two teams, really, if you can manage it. Information crisis, Melissa lasted 5 days. I don't know if many people realize that, but it lasted 5 days. It kept getting mutations, it kept having different functions. People became exhausted. I was on those telecons. People became exhausted. You've got to be ready. Three's better, but I doubt if anyone's going to afford it. You must have the ability to pull the plug. You also must be able to trust the person with that authorization not to unless it's necessary. And one of the hardest things you can do is say, this isn't a problem. I had to do that on Saturday with Freelinks. On imperfect information as usual, but Okay, world's different. Used to be able to say you can't get a virus from email. They fixed that bug. Okay, their features. Anyone ever hear of edit flags? That nice little feature that keeps a user from being bothered if a Word document tries to download. Well, you wouldn't want to have people hit OK that many times. Single layer defense, not enough. We proved that with Melissa. You've got to have multiple layers. The desktop is the key, but you also must have something you can push quickly, and that means gateways and servers. You don't have a choice anymore. Solution, you heard a lot about policy. Yes, you need a policy. The policy is what grants authority. You need an architecture to support a defense. You need enforcement to guarantee the defense, because if you don't enforce it, people won't use it. It's not their nature. It's not their job. You need tools to test it. You need the conviction not to accept less. And you have to understand when a marketeer is trying to sell you less. That's one of the harder things to do. Leave any of those out, and you might as well just keep your resume updated, because it ain't going to work. 10 years of experience with viruses said in a large corporation, leave any of those out, and it's not going to work. Okay, and time, Jack?
Oh, yes.
Questions? Sir?
What are your thoughts on response mechanisms, given that you know that
response, are you talking about automated, or are you talking about things like CERT? The first thing I can tell you is in the early days of Melissa, or early hours of Melissa, a pretty park, free links, explore zip, the information we were getting from reputable sources was wrong. They were missing essential points, like the points about recursing all the address lists. CERT did not get that right for over a week, and yet it was critical in a large corporation in deciding what your defensive posture was. Do we have thousands of infected machines sending 50 messages, or do we have one or two machines sending thousands of messages? And of course, the immediate fix we got for this, to scrub the servers from the Microsoft, lost all sender information. So we couldn't see it was only coming from one or two machines. But each case this year, the expert opinion has been wrong in certain critical areas. For instance, Freightlinks last week, non-event. Saturday, we didn't know it. All we knew was another MAPI virus that will send to the entire global address list. And I'm not going to say how big ours is, but I mentioned how many machines we've got. You can figure it out. That would clog systems. So severe risk. The one piece that was missing Saturday and until noon Sunday was, well, Freightlinks had only been seen at one company in Oslo, Norway, had not been seen outside of that, and didn't work anyway. Minor piece of information that's missing. But when you talk about a corporation responding, you have to assume the worst. You have no choice in the matter. Okay, one final thing. Apparently we have obligatory marketing here, so please buy a Xena. You ever see the props on a C-130J? No, I've lost you completely. Experts out of their field.
Isn't Xena the show that follows Hercules?
Yes. Okay. And if you saw the props on a J, it was. Hercules has straight props, and Xena's props.
How do we get that scripted? How do we get the scripted?